know, Sister says. Today we have to get ready for the new patients. Tomorrow you start working.
Why?
No more school.
What new patients?
Elodie wants to know. Stop asking so many questions.
What kind of work will we have to do?
Claire asks. You'll have to take care of the other mental patients, Sister Josephine responds, and Elodie notices she's made a point of inserting the word other. Other mental patients.
We're not mental patients, Elodie clarifies.
Sister Josephine sets down her spoon and stares directly across the table at Elodie. Yes, she says, her voice cold, her eyes unflinching. You are. An hour later, while the bars are still going up in the windows, a yellow school bus pulls up in front of the red brick building that Elodie has always known as home.
The crazies are here, someone yells.
The orphans crowd around the windows in the front room with nervous anticipation to watch as their strange new roommates pile out of the bus one by one. The children and nuns let out a collective gasp as the spectacle unfolds before them, old men and women shuffling clumsily up the walk in pajamas, some of them babbling and singing, others in stupefied trances.
They're old, one of the children cries out. And scary.
This is the third disturbing thing to happen this day. Elodie feels a knot of panic tighten in her chest. She's old enough and clever enough to understand that life as she knew it is over. Chapter 16. Maggie. On her way to meet Roland at L'Auberge Saint-Gabriel in Old Montreal, Maggie can't help glancing inside her purse to look at her new bra. It's not so much the bra that thrills her as the achievement. The department manager at Simpsons gives a free brassiere to the number one salesgirl every quarter, and this time it was Maggie. She can't wait to tell Roland. With her job at Simpsons and Roland by her side, her life in Montreal is turning out not to be such a bad backup plan after all. They are creating a solid, fulfilling life together in the city, and Maggie experiences more moments of genuine contentment than she ever thought possible. Roland is waiting for her at their table, sipping a scotch. There's a bottle of wine for them to share, chilling beside him. She smiles and waves.
How was your day?
Maggie asks him, unfolding the white linen napkin on her lap.
Far too boring to discuss, he says. I'm reviewing a loan proposal for a small mining company run by two very charismatic and persuasive brothers. They've managed to establish a viable business out there, which I admire. If I don't subsidize them, they'll be swallowed up by Naranda mines. I hate to see that happen.
Maggie nods in all the right places. Roland's cleverness and business acumen still impress her a great deal, but she can't say she finds it interesting. She decides on the escargot and suprême de volaille for dinner.
So it looks like I'll have to go out to Rouen later this month, Roland finishes as the waiter arrives to take their orders. What about you? How was your day?
She reaches for her purse and pulls out just enough of the white lace brassiere to show him, without anyone else seeing what it is.
You bought a brassiere?
No, I won a brassiere, she explains. I was the number one salesgirl this month. Roland doesn't say anything. He finishes his scotch and reaches for the second, which has appeared next to the breadbasket.
Congratulations, he says, staring into his glass.
No smile. No feeling behind it.
Aren't you proud of me? For selling the most brassieres, he says. I'm not sure that's an achievement on par with, say, raising children.
Maggie blinks back tears as the waiter sets down her ramekin of escargot. The smell of garlic and warm butter wafts around her, but now she can't enjoy it. I'm a natural with the customers, she murmurs. I've got my father's instincts.
Let's change the subject.
I want to keep working. Roland puts down his fork and looks straight at her.
You mean measuring women's breasts all day? Where does that lead, Maggie?
Women's apparel. Department manager. Maybe even to a store of my own one day. Roland chuckles sourly.
Get your head out of the clouds, he says dismissively. You haven't touched your escargot, dear. They're delicious. Very buttery, just the way you like them.
I thought you'd be happy for me.
How can I be happy when I haven't got a say in what happens in our marriage?
What does that mean?
A man needs a legacy, Maggie. Otherwise, what's the point?
The waiter delivers Roland's third scotch and asks Maggie if something is wrong with the escargot. She shakes her head and forces herself to smile up at him. She picks at the rest of her meal, tasting nothing. They finish off the bottle of wine, and then Roland orders a cup of coffee to pep himself up for the drive. At home, he heads straight for his liquor trolley in the living room and fixes himself a nightcap.
Drink?
He asks her. She grimaces, kicking off her pumps. She notices one of the heels is scraped from the cobblestones in Old Montreal. She kneels down in the vestibule and rubs the scuff with her thumb.
I want you to go off your birth control, he says,
sitting down on the brocade sofa.
Now?
He leans back against the plump cushions and crosses his leg.
Yes, now. When, Maggie, if not now?
She should have seen this coming, but the truth is she's still not ready. She's not over Elodie. The wounds have not healed nearly enough to start again. You haven't said anything before tonight.
Well, I'm saying it now, he snips. I thought you'd bring it up at some point, but apparently it's not at the top of your priorities.
You're being a bully.
You told me you wanted children.
I said not right away.
And it's not right away, he cries. I've waited patiently for almost 3 years.
I don't feel ready.
You may never feel ready, he says. But it's like diving into a lake. It just has to be done.
Easy for you to say, she mutters, remembering the nausea, the weight, the heartburn, the contractions, the loss.
We have a good life together, Rol. We're happy. We don't need to rush to start a family, not yet.
I'm not going to wait until they make you manager of brassieres at Simpsons, he says. That could take decades.
I don't like you when you're drunk, she tells him.
He stands up, crosses the room to his liquor trolley, and pours himself another scotch.
Funny, he says, plunking ice cubes into his glass. My father felt the same way about me when he was drunk. Couldn't stand me. He did everything he could to avoid me. I rubbed him the wrong way, I suppose, especially when he was drunk.
He sits down, swishes the scotch around in the glass, and takes a healthy gulp.
Every time I opened my mouth, he cringed. I once overheard him say that to my mother.
Maggie is startled by Roland's unexpected confession. He's not in the habit of sharing personal stories with her, even when he's been drinking.
I was more surprised to hear him say it out loud than I was to hear that he didn't like me, he continues. I knew, of course, that he didn't like me. A child knows.
Maggie nods, thinking of her own mother.
I just want the opportunity to do better, Roland slurs. I'd like to try to be a good father, Maggie. Don't you see?
His lids are beginning to droop, and Maggie feels sorry for him. We can discuss this in the morning, she says, when you're not so drunk. He responds with a loud snore. Upstairs, she sits down at her vanity and combs her hair. Maybe Roland is right. Maybe doing better than her mother did would be healing. What if she could make up for every kiss withheld, every caress denied, raise a child who feels treasured and adored? The idea begins to blossom as she gets ready for bed. A baby to love, a life to shape. She could do it with kindness and affection, not anger, with a gentle voice, the balm of acceptance, and all the nurturing that would enable a living thing to thrive. It might even turn out to be redemption for the daughter she gave up. Chapter 17 Elodie 1957
Stay still! Elodie cries impatiently.
Big Abeline barks like a dog and chomps her gums together as though she's about to bite.
You don't even have teeth, imbecile, Elodie says.
More barking.
Stop barking, or I'll get Sister Louiselle,
Elodie threatens. Sister Louiselle is the meanest nun at Saint-Sulpice. She arrived with the crazies 2 years ago to manage the mental patients and teach the other nuns, who previously had only ever cared for orphans, how to run the place like a hospital. Big Abeline growls. She weighs about 250 pounds and could crush 7-year-old Elodie like an ant. Still, it's Elodie's job to wash Abeline before bed, which means scrubbing her back and under her armpits and even her private parts, which Elodie always skips, Some of the other crazies are easier to handle. Petite Odette is tiny and gentle, always cooperative. She has droopy eyes and a slow way of talking. Claire says it's from all the medicine they give her. But Elodie isn't even sure why she's here. Mademoiselle Philidora is another one Elodie doesn't mind taking care of. She's retarded for real, not crazy like the other ones. And everyone likes her. She's always smiling and laughing, happy. She doesn't seem to know or care where she is. She likes to hug and cuddle, which Elodie enjoys in return. Big Aveline is the worst. Elodie hates her, her barking and growling, her sweaty thighs that are always covered in a rash, her unbearable stink.
"Why is she still in here?"
Sister Louiselle says, coming into the bathroom. Aveline barks at her.
"She's not letting me wash her," Elodie complains.
"Go to the dorm," Sister Louiselle says. "Say your prayers on getting to bed."
Relieved, Elodie leaves the room and escapes to the dorm. She drops to her knees and pretends to pray, crosses herself, not meaning it, slides under the crisp white sheet and pulls the wool blanket up to her chin. The younger girls are already asleep, the older ones still working. Elodie lets out a long sigh. Another boring day is behind her. The room is cold for October. She used to love the fall, but that was back when she still got excited about things. There's no more playing outside, no more singing or coloring, no more sunshine on her skin, fall leaves, books, crayons, or hope. She presses her doll poupée to her cheek and closes her eyes. The good thing about working all day, whether she's bathing the crazies or making their beds or washing their dirty clothes, is that by the time she gets into bed at night, she's too tired for sad thoughts or even for listing all the things that make her angry. But tonight, just as she's hovering on the precipice between deep sleep and semi-consciousness, she's startled awake by a brusque shake.
"Eh?"
she cries, rolling away from the intruder.
"It's time to wake up."
Elodie blinks in the dark, trying to orient herself. Outside, it's pitch black.
"It's the middle of the night,"
she moans, recognizing Sister Tata standing above her.
"You're going somewhere, Elo."
Elodie sits up, confusion giving way to exhilaration.
"I'm leaving here," she says.
"Yes,"
Sister whispers, helping her out of bed. She puts her feet on the ice-cold floor and winces.
"Did my mother come for me?"
she cries, her voice bursting with hope.
"Of course not," Sister says.
"Get dressed. Put this on."
"That's not my uniform,"
Elodie says, studying the dress Sister Tata has laid out on her bed.
"You don't need your uniform. Just put on the dress."
"It smells funny,"
Elodie says.
"Shit,"
Sister Tata says, exasperated.
"You and your debating."
"Where am I going?"
"To a new place."
"Why?"
"Because we're overcrowded here."
"Where is this new place?"
"You'll find out when the time comes."
"When will that be?"
"I don't know."
"Why do we have to go in the middle of the night?"
Elodie wants to know, her excitement giving way to dread.
"I don't make the decisions,"
Sister Tata answers, moving down the narrow aisle to one of the other cots and waking another girl, and then another.
"Now go wash up and get dressed."
"But..."
"Stop with your silly questions."
A parade of girls joins Elodie in the bathroom to wash and change. When she returns to the dorm, she counts six of them in total, lined up in their donated dresses, as sleepy and bewildered as she is. That's when she realizes with a wave of horror that Claire is not among them.
"Isn't Claire coming too?"
Elodie asks, panic rising.
"No,"
Sister says, collecting some of the saved trinkets from their first communions and confirmations and dumping them into one small suitcase. Elodie looks around at all the other sleeping girls with a stab of jealousy. Not because she's happy here, but because it's the only place she's ever known, and it's beginning to dawn on her that she's leaving here for good.
"Let's go, girls. The train is waiting."
"The train?"
Elodie cries, always the one to speak up. The other girls are older by at least 2 years, and know better than to argue.
"Where are we going?"
Sister Tata doesn't answer.
"I have to say goodbye to Claire."
"There's no time,"
Sister whispers.
"And you mustn't wake her."
Elodie looks beseechingly at the mound of Claire's sleeping body. How can she not say goodbye? They've been inseparable for the past 5 years.
Why can't I say goodbye to Claire?
She whispers, tears springing to her eyes.
She won't know where I've gone.
Stop whining, Elodie. You'll wake the others.
Elodie reaches for Poupée and clutches her to her chest.
You can't take that, Sister says,
taking Poupée away from her.
I'm sorry. Dolls aren't allowed where you're going.
But Sister...
Hurry up, Elo.
The moment Sister Tata turns away to console one of the other girls who isn't allowed to bring her mother's silver chain with her, Melodie crouches down and grabs all the drawings she's ever made of her imaginary family. She's been hiding them beneath her mattress since the orphanage became a hospital, and now she stuffs them inside her bloomers. She won't leave those behind. With one last look at the room where she slept for as long as she can remember, Elodie shuffles down the hall, tears rolling down her cheeks.
Goodbye, Claire. Goodbye, Poupée.
The air of mystery only adds to Elodie's sense of impending doom as she follows Sister Tata and the other girls down the stairs, shivering in her thin dress. As they reach the landing, she feels someone's hand wrap itself around hers. She looks up, and one of the older girls, a pretty red-headed 10-year-old by the name of Emmeline, winks at her and squeezes her hand. Outside, Elodie can see her breath in the air. A station wagon is waiting to take them to the train station. All six girls climb in the back, while Sister Tata sits in the front seat, her small black Bible pressed to her lap. A million questions are on the tip of Elodie's tongue. Where are we going? How far is it? Why us? Is it a proper orphanage or a convent? But she dares not speak them aloud. Part of her is relieved to be pulling away from Saint-Sulpice. It's never been the same since it turned into a hospital. But her heart feels heavy for the ones she's leaving behind. She is not crazy. She doesn't belong in a hospital, and she assumes they've finally figured out their mistake. Elodie can only hope that Claire will come along shortly with another batch of girls. When they reach the station a few minutes later, they silently pile out of the car and follow Sister Tata single file down the length of the platform. The station itself is in a squat, red brick building beside a track, somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Where are we?
Elodie whispers to Emmeline.
Farnham,
she says, as Sister Tata hands some papers to a man in a funny hat. He checks them carefully and invites them to board.
Bon voyage, he says.
Elodie sits beside Emmeline, still holding her hand. She has the window seat and stares outside with her nose pressed against the glass from the moment the train starts to rumble and shake until it jerks forward and starts pulling away from Farnham. The sun is just beginning to rise, giving Elodie her very first view of the world outside the walls of Saint-Sulpice. The train rolls past miles of bright orange and red trees, vast fields, farms, and cows. Elodie is mesmerized and pensive as she takes in the unfamiliar landscape, trying to imprint all of it in her mind. Her whole body is tingling with anticipation, curiosity, wonderment. Until, with a sudden bolt of dread, something occurs to her.
Sister Tata!
She cries.
Lower your voice, Elo, Sister says sharply. What is it?
What if my mother comes for me?
She asks, tears filling her eyes.
I won't be there.
One of the girls in the seat in front of her snickers, and Elodie reaches out and smacks her head from behind.
Elodie, Sister says.
Will my mother know where to find me?
Elodie wants to know.
Yes, Elodie. There's a record of transfer. Now settle down.
Relieved, Elodie flops back into her seat and rests her head against the window, peering through the glass until her vision blurs and she dozes off. The next thing she knows, someone is tugging on her arm and dragging her to her feet.
We're here,
Emmeline says. Elodie looks around, taking in the gray buildings, concrete, cars, dirt, and funny smells.
Where are we?
She asks disapprovingly.
It's ugly and it smells bad.
Chut!
It's Montréal,
Emmeline explains softly.
We're in the city.
The city? Elodie's heart starts pounding. Another car is waiting for them. It's shiny and new, with the letters B-U-I-C-K written on the back. Elodie can read now, thanks to Claire, who taught her whenever they had snatches of free time. Sister Tata instructs the girls to get inside the Buick. The mood in the car is somber as Sister turns around to look at them with a troubled expression on her face.
Are you going to stay with us?
Elodie asks her.
I can't, Elo. I have to go back to Saint-Sulpice.
Elodie squeezes back tears, trying not to be a baby, but her lower lip won't stop quivering. They drive through the city streets in silence, past tall buildings and the garish signs that loom above them on every corner, dwarfing the landscape. Drink Pepsi. Ask for Labatt. Du Maurier, the distinguished cigarette. Elodie can see Sister Tata's lips moving as she recites her prayers to herself. Elodie is spellbound and repelled at the same time by everything happening around her.
Look at the train on the street,
she cries, pointing out the window.
It's a streetcar, Sister Tata explains.
Finally, the car comes to a stop in front of an imposing gray stone building with a cross at the top of its center colonnade. At first, Elodie thinks it's a convent, but then she notices the words carved into the stone facade. Hôpital Saint-Nazarius.
Another hospital?
She cries.
I don't belong in a hospital.
Sister Tata gets out of the car. The other girls follow, but Elodie refuses to budge.
Get out, Sister says harshly. This is your new home, whether you like it or not. You won't be any worse off than you were at Saint-Sulpice.
Elodie reluctantly gets out and shuffles miserably behind the procession of the other more compliant orphans as they make their way up the front steps. What she wouldn't give to be back at Saint-Sulpice. Once inside the foyer, a heavy double door is opened for them by another nun, and then locked with a single twist of a large, gleaming gold lock. Elodie jumps as it clicks, and then she cowers behind Emmeline. Sister Tata hands over the suitcase and some papers to the other nun, a short, thick woman with a pinched face, thin lips, and small, dark eyes like a bat.
The youngest is 7, Sister Tata tells her, pulling Elodie forward.
The nun looks Elodie over, inspecting her with wide-set bat eyes and frowns.
She'll be in Ward B with the older ones, she says
in a cold voice that makes Elodie want to hide under Sister Tata's skirt. Very well then, Sister Tata says, turning to face the girls.
I have to go back now.
Elodie bursts into tears.
Don't leave us,
she cries, wrapping her arms around Tata's waist.
I don't belong in an hospital.
Sister Tata kneels down and cups Elodie's face in her hands.
You'll be with the other orphans, she whispers. Don't talk back, and you should be fine.
And then she stands up and straightens her habit and touches Elodie's shoulder.
Good luck, girls, she says,
and Elodie can see that her eyes are watering.
Sister Agnesia is in charge of you now.
They all turn to look at the nun whose grim demeanor, cartoonish frown, and harsh voice have already put the fear of God in them.
Good luck,
Sister Tata repeats, unlocking the door and disappearing into the first light of morning. Sister Ignatia moves quickly to lock the door again. Click.
Follow me,
she says, and the girls do as they're told, walking behind her up 6 flights of stairs, and then single file down a long, eerily quiet corridor. Where is everyone? Elodie wonders, but doesn't dare ask. At the end of the seemingly endless hallway, Sister Ignatia stops and unlocks another door, on which there is a sign, Wards A to D. The moment they pass through that door, the place springs to life, assaulting them with the smell of bleach, the purposeful comings and goings of nuns in white habits, and a cacophony of wailing and distant screams. They continue to follow Sister Ignatia until she stops in front of yet another mysterious room.
This is the dormitory for Ward B, she says,
pushing open the door to reveal a huge room with 6 rows of 10 white iron beds, each one placed head to foot, with barely enough space between them for a stubby chest of drawers, no bigger than a filing cabinet. A simple cross hangs above the first bed of each row. 10 crosses, Elodie counts. 60 beds, 60 drab wool blankets. 6 barred windows facing a concrete wasteland and a gray sky as far as the eye can see. In the corner of the room, a terrifying statue of Jesus on the cross presides over them, keeping watch when the nuns can't. Sister Ignatia doesn't give them much time to absorb their surroundings before leading them along the back wall to the bathroom.
You have to go through the bathroom to get to the common room, she explains,
striding ahead of them on short but efficient legs. She pushes open the door to the common room, and Elodie gasps.
What's the matter?
Sister Ignatia says, turning to her with black eyes and flared nostrils.
You've never seen a mongoloid before?
Elodie swallows a thick lump in her throat and nods her head. There was Philidora, But she was different somehow, sweet and harmless, not frightening like these girls.
Better get used to them, Sister Ignatia barks.
The room is organized in similar fashion to the dormitory, only instead of rows of beds, there are dozens of rows of rocking chairs, most of them occupied by girls not much older than Elodie, who are babbling to themselves or snarling like animals, or staring at the wall with weird dead eyes. They all have the same chopped hair. It's hard to distinguish the mentally retarded from the mentally ill. Here in the common room, they're all lumped together. Somehow the sight of young mental patients is more terrifying than the old ones back at Saint-Sulpice.
Why are some of them wrapped up like that?
Elodie asks, pointing to the strange white jackets with buckles.
It's a straitjacket, Sister Ignatia responds. And if you don't behave, there's one for you.
Elodie steps back, still hiding behind Emmeline, and notices a naked girl whimpering in the corner. She's curled on her side, the bones of her white spine prominent, her knees pulled up to her chest, shivering violently. Elodie can't believe her eyes. The girl's wrist is chained to a pipe. Sister Ignatia doesn't acknowledge the girl, nor try to explain or justify the reason for it. It all seems to be part of normal life here at Saint-Nazarius. After the tour is finished, it's time for haircuts. A moon-faced girl, one of the other patients, chops the new girl's hair into a broom style above the ears, with a thick thatch of uneven bangs. When it's done, Elodie stares at herself in the bathroom mirror and frowns. Now she looks like the crazy girls from the rocking chairs.
Are they all as horrible as Sister Ignatia?
Emmeline asks the moon-faced girl.
They got rid of the last ward B supervisor because she wasn't mean enough. In case you haven't figured it out, you've arrived in hell.
When the haircuts are done, the girls are made to line up for inspection. Sister Ignatia rejoins them and gives them a disdainful once-over.
Sister?
Everyone turns to look at the girl, who, with trembling voice, has dared to address Sister Ignatia. It's Emmeline. Sister Ignatia approaches her with a curious expression.
What is it? She says.
I think there's been a mistake,
Emmeline tells her, meeting her icy glare.
We are orphans. We don't belong in a hospital like this.
Elodie wants to cheer. At last, someone has spoken the very words she's been dying to scream from the moment they pulled up this morning. This place is a madhouse, a place for the severely retarded and the lunatics, patients much worse off than the old people from the orphanage.
You don't belong in a place like this, Sister Ignatia repeats,
her lips curling into a menacing half-smile.
Where do you belong?
Emmeline looks down at the floor.
An orphanage, she replies softly. There still might be a chance for us to get adopted. No one will ever find us here.
Without any warning, Sister Ignatia's arm crashes down on the side of Emmeline's skull. The blow is so powerful, Emmeline stumbles backwards and lands on the floor, stunned.
This is exactly where you belong, Sister Ignatia says, standing above her. You were born in sin, were you not?
She paces in front of the frightened girls.
You must never question whether you belong here. You're lucky we let you have a roof over your heads and food in your bellies. It's more than you deserve. Your lives are worthless, and you will be treated as such.
She turns back to Emmeline, who is still crumpled on the floor.
And you, Sister says, prodding Emmeline with her black boot. You will stay in Ward D with the epileptics.
No, please, Emmeline begs. I won't say another word.
Sister Ignatia grabs a fistful of Emmeline's freshly chopped hair and drags her down the hall. Elodie blocks her ears to drown out Emmeline's screams and bites her lip hard to keep from making a sound. She can feel the girls on either side of her trembling, and when she sneaks a peek, she sees tears streaming down their cheeks. The rest of the day is a fog. The meals are inedible, brown meat and soggy vegetables with a drop of molasses smeared on the plate for dessert. The afternoon hours are interminable. The girls are left in the common room to rock in the chairs with the zombies. They haven't been assigned jobs yet, so there's nothing to do but stare at the walls and avoid being noticed by the nuns. At night, Elodie slips gratefully under the itchy gray blanket on her cot and closes her eyes. Sleep will be her only reprieve here. She already knows that. The moment she loses consciousness, she will be free.
Sit up.
Elodie opens her eyes, startled to see one of the nuns standing over her.
Open your mouth.
What for?
Elodie asks, regretting it immediately. The nun slaps her face.
Open your mouth,
she repeats. Elodie opens her mouth and the nun places a pill on her tongue.
Swallow it,
she says, handing Elodie a glass of warm water.
It's to help you sleep.
Elodie lies back down as the nun moves over to the next girl. She lies there for a long time, thinking about Sister Tata and Claire, wondering what they're doing. Do they miss her? Has Claire asked where she is? Will she ever see them again? Her thoughts turn to Emmeline, and she worries for her on the epileptic ward. She doesn't even know what an epileptic is, but it sounds terrifying. And then, out of the ghostly silence, she hears a little girl singing a lullaby from across the room, and she wonders if she's dreaming.
Fais dodo, bébé à maman. Fais dodo.
Elodie tries to move her head to see who it is, but she can't. She's paralyzed. She can barely keep her eyes open, too. Her body is floating now, and she feels strangely calm. The little girl's song is soothing, buoyant in this dark place. She hears someone whisper,
Shh, Agathe! Sister will hear you!
But the little girl continues to sing. Elodie drifts off. Her mouth feels dry and her tongue thick. Her hands and feet are tingling.
Fais dodo, bébé à maman. Fais dodo.
And she disappears. Chapter 18. Maggie digs her hands deep into the soil and breathes in the smell of dirt, a smell she still associates with her father's store. She can practically hear his voice as clearly as if he were standing beside her.
Forget using a trowel and plant the bulbs deep, at least 9 or 10 inches for tulips and daffodils.
She always follows his instructions to a T. As a result, her garden is the pride of Knowlton.
The depth will keep the roots cool and moist during our hot, dry spring. Now mulch the bed with bone meal and bulb fertilizer.
It's 1959, and Maggie is almost 9 weeks pregnant. Having already had 2 miscarriages, both around 8 weeks, she's reluctant to get her hopes up this time. The miscarriages feel like retribution for having given away her firstborn. Since Maggie started trying to have a baby, Elodie has been constantly in her thoughts. She's 9 years old now, no longer a baby. It's strange imagining her growing up somewhere possibly nearby, a complete stranger. Maggie can't stop wondering what sort of girl she is, whom she looks like. Gabrielle? Yvonne? Blonde or dark? Plump or slender? Optimistic, charming, sullen or sad? After the second miscarriage, Violet said,
Maybe something got damaged when you had your baby.
Her mother said,
Maybe God is punishing you.
Both hypotheses are plausible. Motherhood, which so far has proven to be frustratingly out of her reach, seems to be the singular prerequisite for feeling valued as a woman, or being of any worth whatsoever in the world. If she can't get this right, it's hopeless. Her life these days is spent traveling back and forth between 2 grand homes, both beautifully decorated, both lonely. Roland bought the country house in Knowlton after their first miscarriage, hoping it would cheer her up, or at least give her a project. She still works at Simpson's, but she hasn't been promoted yet. Roland works long hours, and Maggie is alone most of the time. Even on weekends, he drives into the city to spend time at the bank, leaving her by herself to rattle around the house. She tries to ignore her percolating resentment. She knows he doesn't want to be around her sadness, but it doesn't work. Roland, in spite of all his assurances and promises of compromise at the beginning, has turned out to be slyly inflexible. Still on her knees, Maggie reaches for the hose and tenderly sprays her flowers. Gardening is meditative for her. This season she planted creeping vincas, which have spread across the rocks like pink carpet. She's got vivid phlox and gentians and geraniums, and spectacular running strawberry bushes along the sides of the stone walkway. She's not afraid to try unexpected things. Sometimes they exceed her vision, other times they fail miserably. No matter what, she loves her garden. Some nights, long after Roland has fallen asleep beside her, she sneaks outside to inspect her work. She'll stand here with her bare feet planted in the dewy grass, admiring her beloved annuals and perennials. It's the garden her father has always dreamed of making as soon as he can take some time off work. He has notes about all the unique and breathtaking bulbs he'd plant, detailed sketches that include perches where he could sit among his flowers, elaborate plans for a stone birdbath, a fountain, a pond full of frogs. He's always dreamed of languid days in which he would do nothing but garden. His office is still full of old plans, lists of potential flowers, brilliant bluebirds, lavender Canterbury bells, snow in summer. But he's never had the time, not with the store and the catalog and the mail order. He always complains he's too busy with other people's gardens to have his own. But Maggie suspects he derives more pleasure from the planning and the daydreaming than he would from actually working on the damn garden. After an hour of toiling in the soil, Maggie stands up. The cramps start the moment she gets to her feet. Back down she goes, doubled over in the grass. She can feel hot blood between her legs even before she sees it on her white shorts. She stays there for a long time, lying in the grass, too numb to cry, too devastated to move. Roland eventually comes home and finds her staring up at the sky.
Maggie? Dear!
He crouches down beside her.
What happened? What did you do?
I didn't do anything.
Were you gardening?
He asks, his tone accusatory.
Did you overexert yourself? You were to take it easy.
You make it sound like I'm doing it on purpose. Roland's lips are pursed.
You were just supposed to. You weren't supposed to push yourself.
It's not my fault.
No, he says quickly. Of course not. It's just another setback.
This is the third one.
We'll go to a doctor, he says. We'll get you looked after. We shall not give up.
Comforting words, heroic. We shall not give up. At least it's something she can latch on to. A few days later, Maggie finds herself staring at the telephone. She's wanted to do this for months, maybe even years. With a sudden burst of courage, she reaches for the receiver and dials. Connect me to the foundling home in Cohensville, please, she tells the operator. One moment, the operator says, her voice crisp and neutral. Maggie lights a cigarette, exhaling into her coffee. Within seconds, another woman comes on the line.
Good Shepherd Sisters, she says pleasantly. This is Sister Maeve.
Nothing comes out of Maggie's mouth. She's staring into the mouthpiece as though it's a foreign object.
Good Shepherd,
the nun repeats.
Hello?
Hello, sister, Maggie manages, with the appropriate amount of humility and respect in her voice.
How can I help you, dear?
Kindness. Maggie relaxes. I'm looking for information about a little girl, she says.
I'm sorry, the nun responds, her tone changing. I can't help you.
Well, but she's my daughter.
If you had a baby and she's here, then she's not your daughter. Unfortunately, you have no rights in this province, dear.
But I'm her mother.
Best forget her. You understand if she's illegitimate, you have no rights. That's the law.
I'm not even asking you to tell me where she is, Maggie says. I just want to make sure she's been adopted.
The records are sealed, the nun says. No one here or at any orphanage in Quebec can give you any information. Pray for forgiveness, child.
Please, I'd be so grateful for anything you can tell me, Maggie begs, the receiver trembling in her hand. I only want to know if she was adopted so I can stop worrying she's wound up in an asylum. She holds her breath, waiting for Sister Maeve to tell her to forget it and move on. The nun sighs.
Do you know the date of birth?
The question catches Maggie off guard. She hadn't really expected to get anywhere.
March 6th, 1950,
she says, her voice shaky.
And the day she was brought here?
The same.
Hold on, please.
Maggie tries to stay calm. Deep breath, deep breath. Her heart is hammering her chest. Sister Maeve is gone for a long time, at least 10 or 15 minutes.
No infant girl was ever brought here that day, she says,
returning at last.
What about the next day?
Maggie asks, confused.
No babies arrived here in March of 1950, she says. I'm afraid you've got the wrong foundling home.
Are you sure?
I'm sorry.
Is there another one in the area? Close to Frelixburg?
The closest I know would be in Sherbrooke, she says. And a good deal of unwanted newborns go to Montreal.
Unwanted newborns?
I'm sorry I can't be of more help, dear. God bless.
The line goes dead. Maggie doesn't move for a long time. She lights another cigarette off the last one. Dida told her that her father took the baby to the foundling home in Cohensville. Why isn't there a record of Elodie's arrival? Maggie impulsively reaches for the telephone and calls her father at work.
Where did you take my baby? She asks him. Maggie?
I spoke to someone at the Good Shepherd foundling home, she says, vibrating with adrenaline.
Dida told me that's where you took her, but there's no record of a baby girl that or any day in March.
They told you that?
Yes.
It's illegal for them.
Where did you take her, Daddy?
Calm down, he says. You shouldn't be dredging this up, especially now. You're pregnant.
Maggie squeezes back tears. She hasn't told her parents about the latest miscarriage.
Where did you take her?
She repeats.
I took her to the foundling home in Cohensville,
he answers, his tone rising.
Just as your aunt told you, which she shouldn't have, by the way.
And I told you no infant arrived there that day.
Where else would I have taken her? He asks. I've got nothing to gain by lying, Maggie. That's where all illegitimate babies were brought. There wasn't exactly an abundance of choice in the matter.
You didn't take her to Sherbrooke? Or Montreal?
I did not.
It doesn't make any sense.
Maybe there was an error, Maggie. I very much doubt their records are foolproof. In any case, you have to put the past behind you. You're lucky to have such a good situation now.
She can hear men's voices in the background.
I have customers, her father says. I have to go. Focus on the baby you're carrying now. The other one is a dead end.
Chapter 19 Elodie 1959 Elodie tries to lift her head off her pillow, but it feels like bricks. The pill they gave her at night turns her into a zombie the next day. She rarely feels awake. Instead, the world unfolds through a foggy, slow-motion filter. She knows from the nuns that the pill they give all the patients is called Lagactyl. Some of the older girls in Ward B call it the lobotomy pill. Even though Elodie is only 9, she already knows what a lobotomy is from a girl named Nora. Nora was transferred from the epileptic ward last spring. When she arrived at Ward B, Elodie wasted no time asking her about Emmeline.
She hasn't spoken since the lobotomy,
Nora said matter-of-factly.
What's a lobotomy?
Elodie wanted to know.
It's when they stick an ice pick into the front of your brain to make you less violent,
Nora explained.
They do it all the time at the surgery.
Elodie gasped, not believing it could be true. She ran to Sister Alice, the only semi-humane nun on the ward, and tugged at her habit.
Is it true they stick ice picks in patients' heads to stop them from being violent?
She asked, breathless.
What are you babbling about, Elodie? Nora told me Emmeline hasn't spoken since she had the lob... the thing where they make a hole in your head.
Sister Alice sighed.
A lobotomy is a perfectly respectable operation, she explained. With the dangerous patients, there's no other choice.
But Emmeline wasn't dangerous.
If you mind your own business and stay out of trouble, she warned, you won't need to get one.
That afternoon, Nora was chained to a pipe because of her big mouth. She blamed Elodie and never spoke to her again, right up till she was transferred to another ward. Elodie lies motionless on her cot, still groggy and dry-mouthed. In some ways, she's grateful for the Lagactyl. Although she hates how it makes her feel during the day, slow and foggy and dim-witted, it does dull the pain immediately before falling asleep and upon awakening. In those few minutes of docile stupefaction, when her thoughts are a blur and her mind barely conscious, she can forget. Everything has a hallucinatory quality. The other patients, the nuns, the hopelessness of her incarceration. The Lagactyl at least neutralizes the despair for a while.
I'm not crazy, she reminds herself. I'm not crazy.
The lights go on and the girls rise from their beds. They shuffle to the washroom, brush their teeth and splash cold water on their faces, trying to shake off the effects of the drug. The best that can be said about Elodie's days at Saint-Nazarius is that she doesn't mind her current job sewing bedsheets in the basement. Her first job was cleaning the bathrooms on all the women's wards, floor upon floor, toilet after toilet. She did that for the better part of a year. When she heard from one of the other girls that there was a job sewing, she lied and said she knew how. Somehow she got away with it, by observing the other sewers, and with the help of one of the old-timers, a kind epileptic named Margot. She was able to pick it up fast enough to keep her job. Apparently, she has a knack. After breakfast and prayers, Elodie makes her way down to the basement, her refuge, and sits down at the sewing machine. It doesn't bother her to sit for hours at a time without a break. The back pain is a luxury compared to how scrubbing floors and toilets made her body ache. Besides, there are worse jobs, like carrying the dead bodies out to the cemetery behind the hospital. Patients die at Saint-Nazaire almost every day, not just the old ones, but children too. Word travels fast through the wards, filtering down from the older girls to the younger ones. In this place full of secrets, there are no secrets. She gets to work sewing her quota for the morning, a dozen sheet hems an hour, 2 dozen by lunch break, letting her mind wander to the hum of the machine. She loses count of the sheets as they pile up beside her, but somehow the correct amount always gets done. Sister Calvert's bell, clanging next to her ear, startles her out of her daze. So goes the monotonous routine of her days. Lunch is some kind of brown meat drowned in thick, clotted gravy. Dessert is always a smudge of molasses on the plate. Afterwards, it's back down to the basement, where she is expected to meet her afternoon quota. The threat of a transfer always looms, followed by more indiscernible mush for dinner, and then back to her ward to rock mindlessly in the creaky chairs with the real crazies. By nighttime, when the nun on duty stops at her bed to dole out the Largactyl, Elodie takes it with a mix of dread and relief. She's grown to like it when her lids get heavy and her head starts to float, the precise moment when reality falls away. Tonight, her last conscious thought before peaceful oblivion is, oh, there's the moon. She wakes up shivering and disoriented, her bed soaking wet. It's still dark and everyone is asleep. She's aware of a pungent vinegar smell. It takes her a few minutes to realize she's peed the bed. For a long time, she lies in her own urine, contemplating how she's going to navigate the maze of beds to the bathroom. Her row is the farthest from it, and she's still semi-drugged. When she finally has a strategy mapped out in her mind, she slides off her cot, strips the sheets, and rolls them into a ball. She creeps carefully along the narrow space between the wall and the first row of cots, but she's still very groggy. Her legs aren't doing what they're supposed to. They feel like cooked noodles, and the room is spilling. The Largactyl is powerfully immobilizing, but she uses the wall to steady herself. What she hadn't counted on was the strewn boot sticking out from under one of the cots. The boot is supposed to be in the cubbyhole at the entrance of the dormitory. Every girl has her own cubby. A small shelf above a hook to keep her precious few belongings. But leave it to Elodie to trip over a stray boot and go flying across the room. Had she been more alert, she might have been able to stop herself from falling so